Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Well, I hope you're all doing good. I should tell you that this episode was recorded during lockdown. And I was very, very happy to get to sit back down with my friend Simone. Simone has already recorded an episode of Off the Beaten Track where we've spoken about a lot about her career in Primal Scream and the songs that have soundtracked her creative journey to date. We have some hilarious stories in there as well regarding Top of the Pops and phone calls from superstars, which I think we touch on in this episode. But go back and listen to the first podcast with Sim because it's a cracking listen. And so what I'm doing with some of the guests that are coming back on is I'm just sort of having a chat, but basing it around gigs and, you know, their first gigs and gigs that, you know, the gigs that I should say that they've both attended and played at. So it's a nice sort of mixture and we get some interesting stories from sort of festivals. And I want to know what it's like, you know, what it feels like to walk out in front of thousands and thousands of people. And we touch on all of this on today's episode. Before we get on with it, also, I need to say that Sim's got a new podcast, so there'll be links to that on the bio attached to this podcast. So go and click through and give Sim's podcast a listen. But in regards to this podcast, I want to say thanks to Scribbis Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to 76, my producer, for producing this. And also, if this is your first listen of Off the Beaten Track podcast, please go and not only check out the first episode I've done with Sim, but go and have a rummage around in the archives because there's probably about 150 episodes with some of your favourite musicians, producers, DJs, comedians, actors. Go get stuck in and have a root around in the vaults. And if that's not enough, I do also have a Patreon page. So each week I put a standalone episode up over there. So if you want to support the podcast, you can do so over on Patreon. You can find out about all of this and merch and all the other stuff off thebeatentrackpodcast.com. All right, shall we get on with things? Let's do it. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful Simone. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we're recording. Sitting opposite me today is my friend Sim. You all right?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. You all right? All things considering.
Yeah, so, well, I want to ask first, Sim, how have you been coping in the current quarantine lockdown scenario as both Simone, the human being, and and Sim, the creative?
Oh, wow. Drinking lots of coffee, for a start. I didn't cope very well at the beginning. I think it was the whole... I think the seriousness of it all really hit. It kind of hit in stages. And suddenly when we were really not allowed to see anyone, and it was like the words lockdown, isolation, quarantine, all these things felt really surreal.
And they're then brutal words, aren't they? They're really like...
They're not brutal words. They are. And they're not really words that we use in our everyday life to describe our lives and how we're living. And I remember seeing it all on YouTube and on the news, like in Wuhan, how everything had just become very dystopian, very surreal, very quickly. No one on the streets, people really struggling, and you kind of thought, oh, it's happening over there. It's happening in the rest of the world, you know. And then, of course, it's here. So, it's taken me a while to get into this headspace that I'm at now. I've really been up and down, like completely honest with you, been really, really up and down. Yeah. And I kind of got really low at one point, got a bit depressed about it all, and just felt kind of very alone. And then, but, you know, you have to realise that everyone's in the same boat. Happening to you, it's happening to everyone. Everyone's had their income and their work cut. And everyone's having to suddenly struggle with that and come up with other ideas and how to monetize certain things. And it's, I don't know, I guess part of the whole thing about being creative without sounding pretentious is that you sort of have to maybe adapt and adjust to what you do, regardless of if there's a pandemic or not. So you sort of have to employ that side of you. But, yeah.
Well, I mean... You've launched a podcast whilst in lockdown, so you've been pretty proactive.
I have. I'm still doing the radio shows, do that. I still want it because I think it's really important to maintain some sense of normality.
Completely.
And I think, like, now more than ever, is the importance of a routine. And just try and do as many things as you did do before to kind of keep that familiarity there. But I did start. I started a podcast. What the hell? Like the world needs another podcast. Like from a musician. And you and Pip are like, you know, that is podcast world. So I mean, I kind of started it to occupy myself. To be honest, I wanted to do interviews with people that I couldn't necessarily do on the radio show because I didn't have enough time. And not everyone can always come in to Soho to do them.
Absolutely.
And I want to reach out. The creative people that are kind of my friends in the industry, I suppose, to see how they're doing. So it sort of started out as that, and I thought maybe I can do something with this, you know. Yeah. And then, of course, everyone's interviewing everyone in lockdown, so yeah. I don't know if it permeates that or not. But it's something I was working on for a while before, and then as this happened, I kind of changed it. Into a different vehicle, I suppose.
Aside from like it being something you'd wanted to do, have you found it? Because personally speaking, I've been recording a lot of like just radio shows in my shed at the end of the garden for my club and things like that. Just because I find it a pleasant distraction from what's going on. Like, you know, I mean, we touched on a message earlier. Like today, we're waking up to, you know, this awful story about the black gentleman that was choked to death.
It was utterly appalling, and I think it's really important to never become desensitized to this kind of violence and brutality, because that's a pandemic in itself.
Yeah.
The
historic pandemic as well.
Of course, yeah. In the echoes of this kind of violence all throughout history. But in my opinion, for what it's worth, if anybody else or a member of the public was to do that, they'd be charged with murder. You know, so why is it acceptable from someone in the police force? You know, you may be on some kind of upper echelon compared to the rest of society, but we're talking about human lives here. I mean, it's just sickening that it's still carrying on. It's really upsetting. And the news today, we did, didn't we? I was just sort of like, I'm really looking forward to this because it's so, difficult to get, you know, like our lives are much more focused online now than they were before.
Completely.
We don't have our day-to-day lives and our interactions and our jobs and that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, there are far more people online. Sometimes it just all hits you at once. You know, there's a lot of anger, right? There's a lot of anger out there, you know.
And I just hope that the fact that, you know, I've not seen this kind of reaction to what goes on regularly in America, I'm sure, but I've not seen this sort of reaction since, you know, Rodney King, really. And I'm hoping
the rioting and the looting and the fires that have been going on now.
Yeah, it's very reminiscent, and I just hope that, you know, the fact that it's caused such, you know, attention and hatred and anger, like that, you know, it does get addressed, because, you know, fucking hell, Rodney King, what was that? Nearly 30 years ago, I imagine. No change.
It makes you wonder, like, really, as a civilization, if we're going forwards or backwards. You know, we're very advanced in some ways, but then in other ways, basic human rights aren't progressing. You know, there's so much corruption. And I think that anger and all that is justified. I'm not saying two wrongs make a right, but people will speak up and they will act out their anger and their frustration. And it's absolutely no surprise to see all the timelines, you know, flooded with Target stores being looted and police cameras being set on fire and you know, people using shopping trolleys as barricades. It's kind of, you know, what's happening to the world?
No, it's bonkers, Jim. It's bonkers. Well, should we talk about something that will be a nice bit of escapism for an hour and talk
I
about?
I very much welcome that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about.
It's hard to tune out of, though, isn't it? It's really hard to tune out of, because, like, you get really and we can't protest. We can't go out into the streets and do anything. We can't even do that. Yeah. So there's even more of this kind of like tangible anger online.
Definitely.
Usually the streets would be full. I mean, you know, with the Dominic Cummings stuff, people would be, you know, protesting outside 10 down the street and all over the place, but can't even do that. And they know that.
Yeah, of course they do. It's a fucking crazy world right now, Sim. It really is.
But, you know, I think it's like the veil has been lifted in certain ways. I think it's always been like that.
Yeah.
These personalities, you know, kind of sociopathic personalities have always been there. I think it's just that we're kind of peeking behind the curtain a bit now, you know.
I just hope that we come out of this, you know, with a little bit of a system restore and, you know, and with a little bit more value on, you know, that you know, the connection with other people, you know, because we've been starved of it. I hope that we all come out valuing that a little bit more.
Like, I think generally people will. I'm not I think people did before. I think we'll have a greater sense of that and importance and the compassion and that closeness and how much we value. We'll have a higher valuation system for it. But whether or not the government will, I don't know if that's their modus operandi, really. Yeah. Compassion, but Anyway, that is another podcast, let's face it.
Right, Sim, I've got lots of questions for you.
Okay.
And my first one, Sim, I want to know what the first ever live show was that you went to.
If I remember rightly, it was Madonna at Wembley Stadium.
What tour was that?
It was the Who's That Girl tour.
Wow.
You know, I was like peak 80s Madonna. And both my parents took me.
Because when you first come on Off the Beaten Track and spoke music, your dad worked in the music industry, didn't he? So
it was at that time he worked at Warner Brothers, and he managed to score some tickets, and we got into this sort of like kind of VIP section. And I remember we were in the bar before, lounging around like VIP bars, even when I was like, you know, 8 or 9. Just such a blagger, man. and I saw the guy from Hot Chocolate there. Is his name Errol?
Yeah, Errol Brown, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember seeing him go, oh my God, it's the guy, it's that guy from Hot Chocolate. But yeah, Madonna, I just remember that, and she was like just being really overtly sexual, and I was really shocked. You know, it was amazing.
Yeah. I remember... I had a huge, huge crush on Madonna then. I think, I don't know how old I would have been then, maybe 13, 14. And I remember there was this thing in Smash It's where she had this like 12 or 13-year-old boy on stage with her that was one of the dancers that went on tour with her. And, and I remember like reading this story that he, when they got to wherever it was he was from in America, like all of his school friends and all that come to the gig, and Madonna like gave him a massive kiss on the lips in front of everyone like on stage. And I remember just thinking, oh, he's the luckiest guy ever. Like Madonna's like kissed him in front of all of his mates. And I just kept thinking, wish Madonna had come to my school and snogged me in front of my mates.
Yeah, that's wild, isn't it, being a 13-year-old boy? Well, he was actually on tour as
Yeah, I remember he had, like, he was a really cool-looking kid and had, like, a little sort of trilby on and was, like, dancing, you know, in I don't know what video it was, but, yeah, she looked...
amazing.
I mean, she was spectacular throughout the 80s, I think, Madonna, I think.
Like, she ruled it in the 80s, man. I mean, yeah, I can't imagine what it must be like to be that stratospherically... famous.
Yeah.
But she, you know, it doesn't happen without good music. So that was her sort of heyday, I suppose.
Yeah, she didn't struggle for a good pop song then, did she?
Say again?
There was no shortage of good pop songs for Madonna in the 80s.
I think the 80s was all about good pop songs, isn't it? Like we discussed.
Right. Sim, well, I want to know what the first live show was that you performed at.
Okay, so like... you know our previous podcast where I had like 7 answers for each question?
Yes. Have you done it again?
No, but I was thinking, because I did classical concerts when I was at school.
Okay, that's cool.
Like 11, 12, 13, I was playing in front of people, but that's not really what you mean, is it? You mean in a band situation?
I guess so. I mean, was there less nerves in a kind of classical performance? Because I presume you was in a bigger bunch of people rather than maybe a sort of 4 or 5 piece on stage.
No, that was the first, I mean... I remember those feelings, the kind of jitters and the anxiety and the excitement and the sort of adrenaline, you know, because our classrooms were the dressing rooms and backstage. Yeah. Everyone, especially, I think, with classical music, you have to be so calm.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're playing violin and your hand's shaking and all this kind of stuff. And, so it was that same thing of getting through a performance anxiety mindset.
Yeah.
But I think, like, as in terms of a band... I'm trying to think. Long time ago. It was probably, there was a band called Dempsey that I used to be in, and the first proper gig we ever did was at the Buffalo Bar in Highbury, Islington, which is not there now. It's next to the famous Cock.
That's pub. Right.
I'm not even sure if that's there anymore.
I think it is.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's got to be. It's called the famous Cock. It's got to be there.
Yeah.
Mom up with a name like that. I mean, come on.
Well,
yeah, to the Buffalo Bar, which was a really cool venue.
Yeah, that was a great venue.
Yeah, that was like my first proper live show. I remember being ridiculously nervous. I wasn't even in the room. You know, when you do stuff and you're just like getting over it. Like that was different from doing classical stuff.
Was there many people there?
Yeah, there was about, I don't know, kind of like 2/3 full.
Yeah.
I seem to remember. So there was a little clique around that band and lots of friends that were in other bands and stuff. So, and it was a bar as well, so it was always
good. Yeah. Was you confident?
No. I think that's part of the thing. Like, I've always wanted to do stuff regardless of whether I'm confident at it or not. If you wait till you're confident to do something, you're never going to do it because doing it gives you confidence.
Yeah.
But no, I wasn't confident.
Were you confident in your abilities, though?
No, because I didn't feel I was good enough. But I wanted to do it. I mean, I still don't. Not that I don't think I'm good enough, but I still know I've got a lot more to learn.
Yeah. Imposter syndrome, though, you can't help but get away from that, can you? It's always...
There is an element of that. I saw a tweet from a really well-accomplished electronic musician the other day on Twitter going, any advice for imposter syndrome? And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. How, what? You know, and I'm sure there were moments where even... You'd like to think that maybe like even Bowie or someone like that, you know, might have thought these things at the time. Imposter syndrome is a weird thing because it's like you separate yourself from the whole thing of feeling like you belong somewhere or being worthy. I think there's other things. I think psychologically there's other things tied up with that. But essentially it's down to self-esteem and confidence, which ultimately only grows the more you do something. So I wasn't really confident, but I was enjoying it too much to worry about if I was confident doing it. I was having fun.
Well, you said that, you know, you was nervous walking out onto the Buffalo Bar, and obviously I want to talk about some of the gigs that you do, that you've done and that you've done with Primal Scream.
Yeah.
But I think you put a picture up on your social media. And it was you on stage at the Stone Roses gig.
Oh my God! Yeah, wow.
I mean, I'll, if it's cool with you, I'll share that when this comes out so people can see. It's fucking insane. I can only equate it to like when you see that sort of shot of Elton John playing whatever stadium it is when he's on his piano with the baseball bat and the sequin. It looks like that. You're looking badass, Sim. And like, and then in front of you is just thousands and thousands.
That was the shot from behind.
Yeah, I know.
Do you know what? That's such a vivid day. I can remember the heat on my face, the sound of the crowd. I felt so calm. I had been, not to go into it, but I had been going through a really awful thing in my life. And that was kind of the end of it at that point. And that was one of the first shows where I walked out and I wasn't in that situation anymore. And I felt like a new, don't know. I just remember that was one of the best gigs I've ever played. It ties in so much with, there's a question that I think is like a bit later, but it ties in so much with being very free in your head.
Yeah.
Is very equal to how much you enjoy the gig and how easily it comes to you and how much we tie ourselves in knots.
Yeah.
All of this shit is kind of our own. Confidence is kind of like, in terms of confidence, it's very transient because it's sort of things that are happening in your life can really get in the way of that. But that was incredible. And that venue and to be there with the band supporting Stone Roses, it's sort of like, everything comes full circle.
Yeah, if you want to start, you know, you want to get a bit of closure and start something, you know, a new chapter in your life, that's a fucking great place to start, isn't it?
It was exactly that, man. There was such a great vibe all night. I'd seen the Stone Roses before, but, like, they just smashed it out of the park. I mean, we were just dancing like loons.
Yeah.
Watching them. And, yeah, there was a triple rainbow. in that there's one of the pictures
where that's right,
like,
yeah,
but they're like a triple rainbow,
yeah.
So that was like, even that on top of it was like, oh my god, everything's like coming together, man.
Oh, but, wonderful,
yeah, it's a great moment. I won't forget.
So, speaking of great moments and rainbows and big crowds outdoors, next question, Sim. First festival you went to?
I think I didn't start going to festivals till I was a bit older, like early 20s. I think it was Tribal Gathering.
Okay.
Proper festival, like on it and just, you know, a whole weekend and completely wrecked for the next few days after. Yeah, it was Tribal Gathering. And it was kind of when I started my period of clubbing and everything that goes along with that.
What did you anticipate was going to happen at a festival, and was it what you expected?
I think so. Looking back, it really wasn't that good.
That's pretty shit.
Having a good time at a festival is a bit of an art form.
Yeah.
No, you kind of have to know what to take with you and when to do this and when to do that and, like, when to maybe have a rest and when to really go for it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, it's a bit like training for a marathon.
Yeah.
and I just went, I took nothing with me. I think I had £20.
Yeah.
And other things.
Yeah.
And my mum. And, you know, it was okay. I remember getting a lift back in a stranger's car and they stopped. Well, with my friends, and they stopped like at a service station, and they bought us like ice creams on the way back because we obviously looked so wasted and awful that they felt sorry for us. We hadn't eaten in about 3 days.
Here, have a Solero.
Our ice cream. Like, I remember that. I remember eating it, going, oh, "God, what is this? Wow." But yeah, it was fine. It was okay. But I've had better times at festivals.
Yeah. Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off The Beat and Track podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. Are you able as a person to, you know, whether it's in a club environment or a festival, are you Are you sort of comfortable to just let yourself go and dance and not give a shit?
I am now. Well, I've been for years. I used to be really shy and really self-conscious. I think the moment you start clubbing, and you know, you might get into certain things, or you know, take certain trips,
sure,
with certain substances, or whatever. I think all those things go a long way to breaking you out of the me show.
Mm-hmm.
No, and sometimes it's really good just to come out of yourself and really lose those things in a really safe environment or a healthy manner. You know, so I definitely, I think any excuse to do that kind of thing now. It took me a few years just to feel comfortable in my own skin.
Yeah.
Well, people are generally self-conscious, you know, for a good reason. It's like a protective layer that we have over ourselves.
Yeah. I can't do it, Tim. I can't.
Like, you can't.
Like, I've got a memory. I've got one memory, Tim, of literally, I could tell you exactly what I was wearing, and it would have been 1993 at a place called the Gas Club in Leicester Square. And it was Errol Alkham was DJing very early, like in an indie club, and I was dancing to Debaser, and I can remember just feeling complete joy, and honestly, I don't think I've ever felt like that since. And I can remember that moment. And it's like, it's really weird. I think because my life then became about putting on clubs and running clubs and DJing.
You've been on nights for so long, right?
You'd kind of seen behind the curtain. And yeah, I don't know. I just could never go back to it and just be completely carefree. I wish I would have done that more. That's definitely a regret. Right.
Yeah, but it's nice to have that as a kind of benchmark, because you don't have to do it every weekend. Like, yeah. if you went there once or twice or 5,000 times, I think the point is that you go to that place.
Completely.
And the nights, you know, the amazing DJs put on, and the night where you meet those amazing people and have those kind of like higher states, like, they never leave you. They really stay with you your whole life, you know?
Okay.
I love that you remember the details and what you were wearing. What were you wearing?
I was wearing a blue t-shirt. I was wearing green check shorts. I had yellow Converse All-Star.
Like a Benetton ad or something.
And I remember I had long hair at the time, and I always had it tied back, and I had it down that night. And I remember thinking, man, my hair looks cool as well. And I just remember having the best time just dancing.
Amazing. I love that.
Sim, when you started in your band, what bands were you inspired by?
When you say your band, do you mean like bands before Scream or Scream? I was in little bands and then it went...
Yeah, no, I will get to Primal Scream, but when you first started out? Who made you want to pick a guitar up?
Andy Fraser from Free.
Right, nice.
Yeah. He's bass playing, and people like George Porter Jr. from The Meters, you know, those bass lines. And, you know, I remember buying the Motown book, James Jameson thing, and all that. But Free was a big deal for me. I just loved those lines, you know. And I loved watching old performances of them and just thought they were brilliant. And Andy Fraser was only like 16 or 17 when he was in that band at the beginning, and he's just, I remember looking at him and he would just be like, there's a footage of them on like Europe, I think it's German TV program, just surrounded by orange ants. And Andy Fraser's just so confident and in the pocket and like big smile on his face and just so in his element. You know, and I remember thinking, God, you know, it doesn't have to be really difficult. You can just enjoy it.
Yeah.
And their bass lines, his bass lines, I felt they were quite easy to learn for a complete beginner, because it's, you know, like I said, it's really in the pocket and it's not overly sort of geographical, like, you know, if you start learning Jaco like Pastorius, it's like, well, you know, it's kind of, you set yourself a bit of a challenge there.
Sure.
I think Free and The Clash, you know, I loved The Clash. I still love The Clash, of course. doesn't it? And the Stooges.
I mean, I can see them behind you. I mean, not actually behind you, but I can see Iggy behind you.
Yeah, my friend Wildcat Will did this. You can't really see it. I've still got to drill holes in walls here and hang it up rather than like lean it precariously against the wall. It's a stencil with all black glitter.
Oh, really?
When the light shines on it, you can see it, but you can't at the moment. I think that I haven't got the right frame for it because it's a bit misted, the glass. Yeah, but I have to put it in a frame. I've just got to look at it. Can't be rolled. I've got so many things I need to frame and unroll, you know.
I mean, you mentioned the Clash. Am I right in saying you've got to meet Paul Simonon?
Yeah, a few times.
I mean, how's that? I mean, that's a moment, right? Surely.
You can stop looking at the gap in his teeth.
Of course.
Wow. You know, he's
how many people can make that look cool? Not many.
Mr. C's got one.
Yes.
Paul Simonon. And yeah, it's cool. It's cool, man.
Did you just say Mr. C?
Yeah.
Sim, that's insane. I've just had a conversation with Mr. C about coming and doing this. How weird's that?
Oh, wow.
That's really bananas.
Yeah, I was watching some of his meditations on Instagram live. Have you seen them?
I haven't, no. I mean, I guess if he's coming on, I best do my homework.
Yeah, he's massively into meditation and he does like guided meditations on Instagram live now on all of his channels because he's been into that for years. Yeah. But he holds workshops and stuff and because he's in LA, he does it in different time zones and yeah, so
wow.
That's great. It's coming on. So yeah, Paul. It's just I first met him when we played Royal Albert Hall.
Just drop that in there. Just leave that one in there. So yeah, when I play the Albert Hall. I was hanging out with Paul Simonon.
Yeah, you know, just the average weekend. Did my shopping, went to Sainsbury's while I was home. And he came up to me afterwards. So I was like, because I kind of spied him from the corner of the room and then we got chatting. Because I always want to chat to people. Like, if I'm kind of like, see like a hero, I think, oh, I'm never going to get this chance again.
Yeah, of course.
Probably going to make a dick of myself, but I just got to say hello, you know.
Yeah.
And we started talking about Robbie Shakespeare and bass and reggae and all kinds of stuff. And I'm like, oh, it's so easy to talk to. He's just lovely.
Yeah.
Great energy. And then he sort of cornered me after and he goes, you know your problem, don't you? And I'm like, oh, God. He's going to impart this, like, bass knowledge onto me. He's going to tell me something's going to change my playing forever. And he goes, your heels are too high. Like, so you can like stomp the stage and run about a bit. Your heels are too high. And I'm like, oh, God. Okay, Paul Simonon.
Well, at least the bass playing's all right. Just got to sort your heels out, Sim.
Yeah, my heels were a bit high that night, so fair play. Yeah.
Okay. What was the first gig you played, Sim? And I mean this with no disrespect to any of your previous gigs, what was the first gig you played that felt like a proper gig? And when I've asked other people this question, I kind of mean, like, there was things like maybe, like, a rider and, like, and there you know, and like, and all of a sudden, you know, you didn't get a five-minute sound check and then the engineer just completely pulled all the faders down once you'd finished your sound check. Like, you know what I'm talking about, right? You know,
yeah, like 12 o'clock at Reading Festival.
Yeah.
There's three people, like,
What felt like, wow, this is like, I guess this is what I thought a gig would be like when I was growing up.
Yeah, the first one that comes to mind was my first proper gig with the Scream because we flew to Hong Kong. We did a live session for Maida Vale. So it was like live radio was my first thing I did with them. No pressure. And then we flew to Hong Kong and we did the gig in front of 30,000 people at Clock and Flap. Yes, it's called Clock and Flaps. Couldn't get away. I mean, there's only like other parts of the world I can get away with calling
it. Of course.
exactly.
We've got a famous cock. It's fine.
Yeah, we've got a famous cock, man. It's all level works out. That was it. And it was kind of, we did it just by the harbour. So we had this beautiful backdrop. And people just went insane. And I was like, wow, okay, this is kind of what it is to be in front of a crowd like this and being on stage and how it feels. And this is like, that was that level of nerves. Now this is this level of nerves. And
so tell me about the moment before you walked out on stage. What was going through your mind? What did Bobby or Andrew say anything to you? Like, no, it was your first gig. Like, you know, don't fuck up. Your heels are too big.
Your heels are too hard. there's never some sort of seance group hug, high five going up, and everyone's just chilled. And, you know, Daz is shadow boxing, and we're doing a bit of a stretch, and, you know, telling a couple of jokes or something. It's not, it, you know, there's that, yeah, there's that kind of tentative just before you walk on stage thing. I love that, though.
Yeah.
I love that. There's not much else that's like that. Being on stage is slightly different, and then there's that just before you go on stage where you're kind of like hyper aware, but then feel yourself going into the zone where you're like, you stop thinking.
Yeah.
Like that part of your brain just starts to shut down. I can't remember on that specific gig. I just can't remember. I just remember walking out on stage.
Can you remember the song you started with?
Might have been Moving On Up.
Right.
I'd have to look at the set list. You know, there's like setlist.com or something.
Yeah.
That would be nice to know, wouldn't it? The first ever actual song I played with them properly.
Yeah.
It was probably Moving On Up, maybe.
Yeah.
But afterwards,
was there like a euphoric sense of kind of relief as well, and that you'd got the first one kind of under your belt, and it was, you know, it weren't the Buffalo Bar, it was fucking 30,000 people. Like, you know, did you feel like, right, this is a bit of me, I want some more of this?
Definitely. Yeah, this, I want some more of this. It was one of those. Yeah. And I was kind of happy that I just got through it and didn't play any bum notes.
Yeah.
You know? But I felt strange. I remember feeling strangely calm, really. I've had gigs at smaller venues, smaller crowds, where I felt more nervous.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of it is your state of mind at the time. Sometimes you can't control how and when your mood sort of goes up and down. Sometimes you feed your gigs in London or your hometown where your family and your friends are there, or you know that quite a lot of well-known musicians are going to be there. You're like, it's like anything, you put that pressure on yourself. Suddenly your ego gets involved and go, ooh, better not do anything that makes you look like an idiot, you know. So
how does it feel? Because I know you're good friends with Manny, and obviously we spoke that you played with the Rosies. Does it feel...
Manny is just like, he's awesome.
So how is that, playing bass... And Manny's there and thinking, oh, Manny's played bass as well. Like, do you feel like any kind of weirdness or like, you know, when you said that there's famous musicians out there, especially if there's bass players that, you know, that you've looked up to and things, like, how do you find that? Do you know where do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. I mean, someone in your own trade or whatever.
Yeah.
You know that, like, when I look at bands, I kind of do look at the bass player.
Right.
You know, if you know there's other bass players in the audience, you're like, well, and if I do something a little bit skew with, they're going to know it. That's just the way it is. This is, you can't take it all on stage with you.
Of course.
You just can't take everything on stage with you.
Yeah.
You know, I love it when Manny comes. Like, I remember the first time he came to see me play with the band, it's like, it's like watching some guy fucking your ex-girlfriend. It kind of is, you know.
Brilliant.
He's there. It just feels like part of an extended family.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful.
He's like one of the funniest people you could ever meet. And he's just got such a brilliant energy and such a good heart that...
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, but you go and smash it. You fucking smash it. Love you. You know, he's all
brilliant.
Behind it. So, yeah. Keep threatening to do like a double bass thing on stage.
La, that'd be great. I actually saw Manny's first ever gig with The Scream.
Where was that?
It was at Chinnery's, no, the Esplanade in Southend-on-Sea.
Wow.
And it was a Glastonbury warm-up. And it was... It was a small venue and it was fucking loud. Really loud. Question six, Sim. Is there a band that whenever they tour, you try to go and watch them?
Yeah, there's a few. The OCs, because they're just incredible live. You can never see them enough times live. Nine Inch Nails. And I really love Cigarettes After Sex. Had tickets to go. Say again.
Who's that? Sorry.
Cigarettes After Sex.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. They just don't sound like anyone. They have one of the most incredible live sounds. I mean, I've seen them a few. We've been on the same bill, and I've watched them from the side of the stage, from the front. I've been in the audience. I don't know how they get such an amazing live sound. I mean, wow. I just really enjoy their music live. They make great music and albums recorded, but live it's kind of like,
yeah,
all these bands really.
I think the same could definitely be said for Nine Inch Nails. Nine Inch Nails live is quite the experience, isn't it?
I saw them live for the first time ever a while back when they did the Robert Smith Meltdown at South Bank.
That's right, yeah.
And that's kind of a weird thing, you know, seeing them in a seated venue.
Yeah.
Because you just want to lose your shit, you know.
It's so weird, Sim. I found myself at several gigs where they're bands that I grew up watching and all of a sudden they're seated and I just think, oh, no, what's happening to me? I don't want to sit down and watch the Lemonhead, Sim. I want to pretend I'm 18 again. I don't want to be kind of sitting down, stroking my beard. It's like, fuck's sake. I literally had two in 2 weeks. I went and saw the Lemonheads do Shame About Ray at the Barbican, and then it was, and then I saw Grantley Buffalo. And they were two bands whose albums in the early 90s blew my socks off. And the thing was as well, Evan Dando walked out on stage, and he still looked fucking 21. And I was just...
Same. Yeah. He looks the same. I don't know what is going on, but he looks the same, yeah.
Like, and I just think, the amount of stuff that guy must have put in his body as well, yet he still looks incredible. And, yeah, but I had to sit down, and it was like, oh, no, I've hit that age now. I've got to start sitting down at gigs.
It's like, but you can't have where people put venues, no.
Yeah, of course.
Some of the best sounding venues are when people are seated. But, I mean, yeah, Nine Inch Nails sitting down is weird. But it did give you a chance to just take it all in.
Yeah.
I remember going to see Suicide at the Barbican.
Yeah.
Sitting down. I mean, that was weird.
I saw Suicide by mistake once. I had tickets to see Grinder Man.
Oh, my God.
So I was prepared for an evening of sinister noise. Right.
Yeah.
And I walked in and there was a guy in like a 1990s silver puffer jacket done right up, just screaming inaudible nonsense over this incessant, almost shit techno. And I was like, what the fuck? And don't get me wrong, Sim, my ears are always open for some new experiences and something.
Yeah.
And it took me about 10 minutes of going, this is fucking terrible. And then I just thought, oh my God, this is Suicide, isn't it? And I own a lot of Suicide records. And I have a lot of time for them. But what I saw that night, whether it was new material, oh my God, it was unbearable.
So
not in a good way. What's that?
They support and Grindr.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a gig, man. Suicide and Grindr Man.
Yeah. I mean, on paper, Sim, sounds great.
Huh?
On paper, it sounds great, but I would have maybe switched suicide that night. It weren't good. It weren't good. And it feels weird saying that because, like, you know, they're utter pioneers. But, yeah. Oh, that was really unpleasant.
Like, God.
But wow. Grindr Man were fucking sinister.
I really wish I could see the Grindr Man stuff live. I mean, I'm such a fan of Nick Cave.
Yeah.
In all of his incarnations.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Grindr Man, I'd kill to see those songs live.
Yeah. He's one of the greatest front men ever, I think. I was talking about it to, I think I was talking to yesterday about it, and I was saying it's not just because he was talking about the Glastonbury performance where he plays where he's doing Stagger Lee, and have you seen that one where he goes out into the crowd and the girls like lifted on someone's shoulders and he's just literally serenading her with this sinister fucking record, like, and I just think he looks like. And sounds like what he's singing sounds like he's about to murder you. He looks like he could murder you and not give a fuck. Yet you just fucking fall in love with him because everything about him's like the way his suits are cut, everything, especially the way that people like Nick Cave gigs, they like him. So he just looks like the fucking devil, like leaning over you in the shadows. And it's just an experience that if no one's ever seen Nick Cave live and you get a chance, do it because it's the most dramatic.
Yeah. He has an incredible presence no matter where they play.
Yeah.
And I've seen him at different venues and saw them at the O2 years ago. Wow.
Yeah.
I went in fully prepared for it to sound like a gig at the Ideal Home exhibition. You know, how can this have a vibe? Sorry, some weird noises going on there. But I mean, he made it feel so intimate in the way he works stage, the way he moves around, and yes, the lighting. And I mean, I've never heard a crowd. It's not often that you can hear how intensely a crowd is involved because they're not talking, they're not like all this kind of stuff. And then I saw him at All Points East playing the outside. Yeah. I thought, oh, maybe some of this is going to get lost into the ether. And again, everyone was like,
yeah.
He just gets crowd like that. He's just magnetic. What a guy. What a multifaceted, talented, lovely man.
4, track 7, Sim. I want to know about your first ever tour, either as support or headline, and I want to know who was on the bill, and I want to know what. Well, I'll start with that bit first. What was your first proper tour?
You know, I didn't really properly start touring until I was in the Scream, believe it or not. Okay. Did runs of gigs with other bands, but it wasn't like touring, you know. I desperately wanted to go on tour. I just thought the idea of it was amazing. And then I did. And, you know, I got to do it with this amazing band. So I'm really lucky.
Who was your first Scream tour with? Who was, like, was your headlining?
Our tour, we did, the first thing we did was we went to Australia, Hong Kong, did the Cochrane Flat, and that just tickles me. can't say it without a little wry smile.
Of course.
And there were a few dates in Australia. It was kind of like a run of shows. You know, immediately I was in Australia playing in front of loads of people. They were our shows, though.
What was you anticipating from touring as a young Sim looking at, you know, bands in the Enemy and things like that and hearing these stories about touring and probably reading about Primal Scream tours as well? Like, you know, what was your anticipation of not necessarily going on tour with Primal Scream, but just going on tour and then did it meet your expectations? Did it surpass them? Did it completely change your idea of what touring was?
I didn't have much to compare it to when I went on Scream at all. I think you have this idea that, I mean, there's touring at different levels, you know, there's being hot box in the back of the transit van with guys who haven't washed for like 6 days. And then there's, you know, being able to have a decent hotel room and have a few hours rest before the show. If your jacket falls apart, you've got a tour manager who can help you out and stuff like that. So, I guess this kind of idea that it's just fucking debauched and drug-fueled and deprived. And, no, I mean, that's there if you want it.
Yeah.
Sure. No, it's just a bit more grueling when you do that at a lower level.
Yeah.
It's harder. It's like, that's why I think it's okay when you're 19 or 20 or 21.
Yeah.
But, like, you get to, like, your late 30s, it's sort of like, you know, you've got to kind of be okay for on stage. I think you sort of, I guess your priorities change.
Yeah, you're just of course. Like, you have to look after yourself more, don't you?
Yeah, try. The gig is the reason you're there. And I think maybe, like, you know, I think the bottom line is it's work, you know. Yeah. You're there to do a live show and to make the live shows as best as possible, but have a fucking great time doing it, whatever that involves, but always be on form for the show.
Yeah.
I suppose it takes a while to kind of find that balance.
Definitely. I'm literally halfway through watching a documentary. I started it this morning. I couldn't sleep last night, and I'm up really, really early. And I generally trawl like Amazon Prime for like music documentaries. And there's actually one I watched the other week on the making of Screamadelica, actually. It's a really, really good watch.
Oh, yeah. I think it's the one that I think I've seen. There's you've got like Andrew and Bob. Yeah. Andrew's the mixing desk talking about Night Stars.
So I watched that and I went back and watched Searching for Sugar Man again, and it just restored my faith in humankind.
I've seen him live.
Oh, wow. Tell me about that, Sim.
Yeah, it's a couple of years ago. I think that was at the Royal Albert Hall as well. Wow, my memory's fucked. But, yeah, Rodriguez. He came out and he was absolutely wasted.
Oh, really?
Absolutely wasted. Yeah, he had to have help getting on stage and getting on the stool.
Wow.
Because I think he was so nervous that... He must have just been necking the whiskey to kind of counteract that.
Yeah.
And at first, he was sort of not making much sense and he was wobbling about and the guitar was, and you're like, oh no, this is difficult to watch. Oh, and then as it went on, he kind of found his strides and then it became amazing and then it became emotional and then people were crying and then he got really funny and really witty. And he had the whole audience like that. And then you could feel how much everybody loved him.
Yeah.
And it was a really magical gig.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, you know, welling up. It was just really incredible, especially if you've seen that documentary.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. That's a must-see. I've literally was halfway through one this morning, which was the story of the drummer in Hole. I don't know if you've seen that yet. I think it's Patty is her name. And it's talking about like the career of Hole and all of this stuff that she documented. She filmed so much stuff. And there's like so much footage of kind of like Kurt with like, you know, baby Francis. And it's a real kind of, it's all footage I've never seen before. And it's that looked like that was a very difficult band to be in, Hole. There was some
comments. Yeah, there's a lot of drama going on with that.
Everything.
Yeah.
It was bananas.
You know, just as a side note, Dock and Roll, the Dock and Roll Festival have a film channel now, and they basically, they're a festival that only do music documentaries, and they have a Dock and Roll TV. If you go on it, there are so many amazing, obscure music documentaries on it.
Wow. No, I mean, where is this? Is this on YouTube? Is this on...
They're friends of mine that run it. It's just called Dock and Roll.
Yeah.
Roll, but Dock and Roll TV.
Yeah.
If you look at that, there are just amazing music documentaries that they put up, and they've been working for a few years, like with the festival, and now they have the streaming service. it's definitely worth a look if you want.
Oh, that's
to look at.
Nothing gives me more joy than a good music doc, Sim.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they do all the ones, not to quote your podcast, but all the ones that are a bit off the beaten track.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, that's what you want, isn't it? You want.
You don't find on iPlayer or Amazon Prime and stuff like that. You know, bands you've never heard of. You know, I remember them doing one about the band Death, but didn't really know anything about.
Yeah.
But, yeah, really good.
Oh, I'm going to so go and check that out when we're done. Question eight. Tell me some of the bands and artists that you've really enjoyed touring and playing with.
Do you mean like support tours or just do you mean
yeah,
like
support bands or bands that you know you generally find yourself at festivals with and kind of like hanging out with? Like just some of the bands that you've enjoyed sort of spending time playing with. And
we did a run with Bone Ingham. They're lovely. Nice. Love those guys. So incredibly talented, unique, very down to earth. We did a run with The Cult. I fucking love Ian and the guys. Like, they're just amazing people. Really inspiring. Really.
I mean, that's quite a mad sentence, isn't it? Right there. We've done a tour with The Cult.
We did. We did. It was called Primal Cult.
Oh, I see what you've done there.
Yeah, we did basically gigs in the States, you know, and...
So you get to hang out with Ian and Billy?
Kind of. Well, they kind of keep themselves, because obviously we travel separately, and then when we get to the venue, they sound check, we sound check, and then everyone needs their kind of time to eat, dress, and rest stuff. So mainly after the show when people are a bit more... there were moments before, there were these little moments that when you are touring with a band, you kind of, you don't want to get in each other's hair or hassle each other.
Yeah.
You really respect that they have to kind of get into a mindset before they go on stage. So you're just respectful of that. But then there are moments where you're both walking down the corridor, you share a little, you might be eating at the same place or you're hanging out in the dressing room or something. And it's just these little magical moments that kind of make touring really memorable and special.
Yeah.
So those guys, God, who else do you think? I can't remember. They're the two that come to mind, really. I mean, there are bands that you sort of catch around the same festival circuit sometimes. You know, I mean, we played a couple of times with Johnny Marr last year as well. He's just a lovely human. And, sometimes you can dovetail somebody around if you're on a tour with them or if you keep seeing each other on the same festival bill and stuff. You can say hello.
So Johnny's done your podcast, hasn't he?
He did a great one. He's so interesting. It was like the most in-depth chat I've had with him, because I've chatted to him on my radio show a couple of times.
I fucking hell, Sim. How many times have I got to tell you that you know he's my dream guest? And now you're telling me he was just such a good chat. And I've had him on my radio show twice. Fucking hell.
I'll send you it and then you can edit your voice into it.
That'd be amazing.
I can put you in touch with him.
So tell me... like a little bit about the podcast and the kind of the sort of structure of it, and you know, is it, you know, what's the kind of sort of format of it?
Oh God, I wish I had a format.
is it just a good chat?
Pretty cool kind of thing. I don't really ask the same questions every time.
Yeah.
It is loosely based around what's going on and how people are sort of coping in lockdown, because I think. It's good for people to know like how their favourite musicians are doing and their favourite creatives, and it's interesting for me, you know, to kind of get advice on, you know, what should I do, how should I approach this, what should I think about, and it's a little bit of the backstory of how they came to be doing what they're doing, and some of it goes off on a tangent. I try to keep it about music. It's mainly music and, you know, people in creative industries. You know, some of my friends are stand-up comedians that I'm going to get. Some of them are radio hosts, as well as musicians, some DJs. So,
all within sort of creative fields.
Yeah. I'm interested in how this period of lockdown affects that and what people are doing to adjust to that. So it's a lot about that. But it's mainly an hour. Johnny's was two. Sorry, not rubbing it in.
For fuck's sake, Sim, all right.
I owe you a pint, man. I kind of try and treat it like we're just sitting in a bar having a drink or, you know, a sparkling water, about life and music and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like yours because yours is a bit more structured. So I think that kind of gives you, well, you know what you're getting. So I'm really experimenting. Like, I'm not an experienced podcaster, so I'm kind of getting to grips with it. Like, I've interviewed people on the show, and that's always like a bit more of a constrained time frame. So,
yeah, but I think there's more pressure in what you do there, Sim. I mean, you was kind enough to invite me on your radio show, and I was petrified.
You know,
I was so nervous, because live radio was really strange, and it was, you know, I'd never done that before. I thought it was really quite sort of intimidating. And then literally, if you remember rightly, just before we went to go on air, one of Primal Scream walks in the studio as well, and I was like, oh, well, this has really weirded me out right now.
You, people gravitating. Scream magnet. Live radio, though, than doing the pre-recording.
Yeah.
Because I'm so hung up on the editing after it.
Yeah.
But
in regards to any sort of structure in podcasts, like, I mean, this is obviously a different format to the normal one that you've done already, but it was just in times of lockdown, it's like, well, I'm going to try and reach back out to the people that I've really enjoyed chatting with. Do you know what I mean? And like, that was the first time we'd kind of chatted, and you know, I like to think we've become pals. Do you know what I mean? And you've come and DJ'd for me and Pip and stuff, and come down the radio.
Yeah,
show.
I love that, by the way. I can't wait till we can do stuff like that again.
I know, mate. Tell me about it. But the reason that I wouldn't say it's that structured, but them little questions I have, they're just a little anchor points, just in case I need to fall back on something. I can go right, and then so for this track, and then it's the answers are not that important. It's all the stuff that kind of, you know, fills the spaces.
Yeah, I have those points. I have those sort of points.
Little anchors.
I mean, I did. You what? Oh, anchors. Yeah. I was interviewing someone the other day, and I had my notes, like, you know, on your iPhone.
Yeah.
And about 10 minutes, it was like an hour interview, and then 10 minutes into the interview, I accidentally deleted all of the notes. And then, I mean, it's not like I didn't know this person, but still, you know, there were so many things I wanted to cover. And then I looked and deleted where it would have been.
Yeah.
And it's like, nope, I've deleted it from the deleted. I'm definitely not shit creep without a paddle. So I was just, as they were talking, I was going, yeah, so then they finished talking. I was like, I managed to get through it, but
well, look, when this episode's finished, I want you to tell me who that is. I'm going to listen to that one. I'm going to see if I can work out the exact point when you just think, oh fuck.
Yeah, in the background, because it's on their audio file.
Well, you know what you got to do, because I was watching another music documentary about Dusty Springfield the other day, and Dusty's iconic wrist flicks that she would do, all of that, which I'm doing now on camera. I don't look quite as... Yeah, there you go. Like, Sim's looking way more graceful than me doing it. But she used to write the lyrics on her wrist.
Oh.
So she would do all of this because it helped her remember the words.
I think it's amazing that lead singers, like, can remember all of the lyrics. Like, when we're talking about people like Nick Cave.
Yeah.
I've never seen him forget a lyric.
Yeah.
You know, I just think it's like...
Must have 300, 400 songs to his name without the poetry.
No. I mean, you know, I got so much respect for that. That's another... It's just another discipline in your brain, isn't it? I mean, I guess it's like remembering a bass line or remembering a guitar part.
Yeah.
But, you know, and when you've written it, it kind of goes into your head anyway. But nerves can really throw you off sometimes. And the first thing that would go, if I was a singer, would be like, you know, lyrics.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Next question. With gigs recording, releasing, what differences have you noticed in the industry now to when maybe you first started playing music?
Gigs, recording and releasing.
You're lucky you're in a band that's kind of got its mindset right on all of them things. Do you know what I mean?
I'm in a bit more of a privileged position. Not that I was never in bands before, but I wasn't in a band to a degree where...
What I meant by that was I didn't mean that you was privileged in to be in Primal Scream. What I'm saying is Primal Scream is...
Obviously I am.
Yeah.
Got a viewpoint in that sense.
But Primal Scream's mindset of, you know, politics and standing and they're on point. Do you know what I mean? Never question their ethics. That's what I kind of meant.
Yeah. Do you mean like how I feel the industry's changing?
Yeah, yeah.
I guess really I feel maybe it's harder to generate income and revenue from just releasing physical records,
yeah.
You know, and having an online presence and being able to stream music is so necessary. Mm. You know, I guess if you don't do that, you're kind of cutting off a certain amount of exposure and maybe income as well. You know, so I think...
I think it's very easy to kind of teeter on kind of sounding like, you know, me sounding like middle-aged old man when I talk about the merits of, you know, the good old days of record shops and vinyl and things like that. But I guess but with that mindset also comes the payoff for that was bands were supported as well. You know, bands had an opportunity to make money then and you know, make a living out of being a touring band. And, you know, we now live in a world of 360 deals and things like that, which can kind of make life for new bands trying to break through very difficult. And even if they do break through, I mean, tell me if you think otherwise, Sim, but like if that first album don't shift X amount of units, chances are that major label's not going to give you a second album.
Yeah, I think that's the same on even independents. Everyone's... Yeah. Got a certain amount, everyone's got a cut-off point.
Yeah,
you know, I know people releasing albums in this pandemic who are still up against that. If they don't sell a certain amount, then the deal's not going to be there after this.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, and they can't go out and tour that record to support it either.
How do you promote, you know, unless you've already fairly established and built up a fan base and your album is utterly brilliant?
Yeah.
You know, how do you generate that kind of thing? You can't, I mean, a lot of bands, you know, get that point of sale from selling merch as well.
Yeah.
And that's something really, really important. You know, people going, I think actually people have come back to buying physical, you know, the last 2 years. People have come back to buying physical version of things, you know, and... That's just the importance of supporting the label, you know, smaller independent labels, I feel like, have just become a bit more prominent now.
Definitely.
Definitely. And that's made it easier for perhaps smaller bands to kind of get up onto that platform and get a piece of the action.
Agreed.
But I know, you know, a couple of my friends are running small independent labels and the financial constraints are obviously much more.
Completely.
But people's taste in music is so massively varied now, and I think the demand for different music and different subcategories of music is kind of stronger than ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an industry expert at all. I'm only seen it from musicians or performance kind of side of things. I guess if you were to talk to like the head of labels, it'd be a much more in-depth answer.
Okay.
I think just bracing, you know, the ability to reach your fan base and monetize the situation online is much more thing.
Definitely.
Sure.
Sim, I've got two questions left for you, mate.
All right.
What's your favorite venue?
Like,
wash
go
it.
And wash
it. Go and wash it right now. It's been shut for 2 months. It needs a scrub.
I've got a few. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course. It's you. Of course there's going to be a few.
Oh, God. Wow, I sound like Bart Simpson when I laugh. Glasgow Barrowlands has worked its way up to one of my favourite venues.
Lovely.
We did a couple of shows at the end of the tour, end of last year, and it's amazing.
I mean, that's a homecoming, right?
Yeah, but it's not my home.
Yeah.
No, but it's the home for the guys.
Yeah.
For Andy and Robbie, at least. And the Glasgow crowd, man. Wow. Incredible. And that venue is just incredible.
Yeah.
You know, it's the old building and the vibe there is amazing. Another one in that sense would be like Manchester Albert Hall. It's just another magical venue.
Yeah.
And again, it's like northern audiences.
Yeah.
They lose it. You know, yeah. It is a different vibe. I really like the Cigale in Paris as well.
Oh, okay.
And there's one in Mexico that we played. I can't remember the name of it. It's a kind of newer venue, I think. We played there the night after Trump got elected.
Okay.
In Mexico.
Wow.
And it went off. I remember we got to the airport and people were just like, the mood was like palpable. Then we went on stage and everyone was waiting to kind of like let go.
Yeah. What a fucking crazy country to be in the day after Trump gets elected.
Yeah. But the venue we played, I'll have to get the name of it, you know, like add it in the subtitles, but that was one of the best venues as well. Sound wise, design wise, vibe wise, everything.
Yeah.
There are so many. No. Of course. Indecisive.
Right, okay. Well, I'm gonna pin you to five. You're only having five for this last question, Tim. Like, you're not having 15 honourable mentions, mate. Right. Five acts, alive or dead. Who would be in your dream festival lineup?
Okay. It would have to be the Stooges. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is
this in any order, or are you just throwing them out?
No, God, I'll do an order. Can I do an order after? I can't possibly think about that.
Stooges.
OCs.
Okay.
I think I'd have John Spencer Blues Explosion.
Oh, great shout.
Yeah, because they're just fucking wild. I remember going to see them in LA. God, sorry, that sounds ridiculous. But in LA, in this place called Echo Park. I think it's a place called The Echo in Echo Park. And they were late and they had just arrived from the airport and they literally walked straight into the venue. It was all set up, but they walked straight into the venue. He put his guitar down, opened up the case, was sweaty, ugh, and plugged it in and just started the gig like that. Oh. And that was one of the best things I've ever seen.
Yeah, what a band.
The third at the 100 Club was pretty wild. In fact, yeah, Bob Log. I think I'd have Bob Log the third as well.
Nice.
You know,
I don't know.
Because he's nuts. Like, he does the whole thing in like an all-in-one and the crash helmet with the old handset, like the phone handset.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's four.
Yeah.
Have rides.
Oh.
Have rides as well.
You get a high five there, Sim.
High five. I just got them in Antwerp in January and they were the best I've ever seen them.
I saw them
doing the new stuff now with the old stuff as well. It's like so good.
It honestly, like, I had a guest on this podcast and she was an absolute delight. And she was like, "Oh, you should get my friend's husband on. He was in Oasis." And I was like, "Oh, okay." I said, "Like, who's that?" And she went, "His name's Andy Bell." And I was like, "He's in Ride. Like, I ain't bothered about Oasis. I mean, yeah, they're cool, but he's in fucking Ride." And like, and so yeah, she facilitated it to get Andy to come and chat on this. And I mean, Andy's done your podcast, am I right?
He has, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
What a lovely guy, right?
He's lovely. He's just lovely. So down to earth, incredibly talented, very interesting. You know, just very calm.
Yeah.
You know, lovely.
So. Yeah. Oh, how many episodes are out now, Sim?
Oh, just two. I've got about, I mean, I've got like series one is about maybe seven or eight. I couldn't possibly tell you who's coming on because it's a surprise.
Okay.
Yeah, I've had Ghost Pirate so far. He was brilliant. He has an amazing album out.
Okay.
Johnny as well. And then I've got another one. It's weekly. I try to drop it every Monday.
Okay. Where can people listen to that?
You can go to iTunes or Spotify or Acast, and it's just called Closer with Simone Marie.
Sim, I will put links to it when I put this out. And yeah, Sim, it's always an absolute joy hanging out.
I'll always love talking to you, and you have to come online.
I would love to. Nothing will make me happier, Sim. I love hanging out and chatting tunes with you. And because you're the only other person I know that likes Terence Trent D'Arby.
I re-listened to that interview and I kind of like, I should not have said that. Just shut up.
If you're wondering what that is, go and check out Sim's first appearance on Off the Beaten Track, where she talks about getting a phone. It was a phone call, not a letter, wasn't it? It was a phone call from Terence Trent D'Arby. Oh, amazing. Sim.
Check out all of Stu's other podcasts and show.
Sim, thanks so much, mate.
Thank you.
Take care, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There you go. Love catching up with Sim. Super fun, super interesting. One of the coolest jobs in music, playing bass for Primal Scream. Fountain of knowledge on music and just a smashing person. And so, yeah, had a really good time recording that. And as I said at the beginning, please go and have a root around in the archives if this is your first listen. Or even if it's not and you've missed a few, go and have a little look. Better still, subscribe. If you subscribe, then each week an episode will just pop up on your listening device. You won't have to do anything. And you can get stuck into some more stories from some wonderful creatives talking about the music that soundtracked their creative journey to date. All right, I'm done. I'm out of here. Thanks to you lot again for listening and supporting this podcast. Thanks once more to Sim for giving up her time. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. Podbiblemag.com. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.